Today on Against the Grain, most of us can't contemplate the threat of nuclear annihilation. And since the end of the Soviet Union, most activists have turned to other issues. But the nuclear threat never went away, and now Trump appears to be launching a new arms race. Yet over the last 40 years, activists with the Plowshares movement have put their bodies on the line to oppose nuclear weapons. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with two members of the Kings Bay Plowshares 7, who both face up to 25 years in federal prison, about the danger posed by nuclear weapons and how their community sustains civil resistance, which demands great personal sacrifice. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. In February, Trump pulled out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. The U.S. has also begun construction of its first long-range nuclear weapons since the demise of the Soviet Union. Both indicate an end to over 50 years of traditional nuclear arms control. Yet the kind of mass movements against nuclear weapons that grew up in the 1970s and 80s are not to be found. However, since that time, dedicated activists with the Plowshares movement have consistently committed acts of civil resistance against nuclear weapons, most recently the Kings Bay Plowshares 7, who last April broke into a Trident submarine base in Georgia. They are facing up to 25 years in prison. Today, I'm joined by two of the seven. Claire Grady is a longtime human rights activist. And Martha Hennessy is a Catholic peacemaker. She's also the daughter of Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. Martha, why did you choose the Kings Bay Trident submarine base for your actions?
This naval base is home port to six of the U.S. Trident subs and three or four of the United Kingdom subs. They are also maintained there. And this is the deadliest weapon system on Earth. It has enough firepower to destroy all life on Earth, causing planetary extinction and annihilation. And we chose to go there for our symbolic action to raise awareness of the deadliness of this particular system.
And what did you do when you were at the base? How did you get in, and what action did you take?
We walked through a gate, and we brought with us an indictment, and we also left a book, The Doomsday Machine, written by Daniel Ellsberg, and we poured blood, and we put up crime tape, and we symbolically disarmed a mock missile display. We call it the missile shrine, and we symbolically hammered on those missiles and poured blood and left a banner that read, "The logic of Trident is omnicide."
Claire, why was this an act of civil resistance, not civil disobedience?
We understand that the supreme laws of our land outlaw weapons of mass destruction, and that these weapons are the ultimate weapon of mass destruction. So it's often spoken of as international law, like it's not U.S. law, but actually all treaties, pacts, and protocols that we have signed and ratified according to Article 6, Section 2 of our Constitution become supreme laws of our land. So we have these treaties, and most people know that we don't always do so good with treaties. Native people of this land would be the first to tell you that. But we do have these treaties that were hard won after lots of bloodshed in major wars last century. And so not only are these weapons that don't discriminate between civilians and non-civilians, or combatants and non-combatants, and are not only are they weapons that contaminate the water, the land, and the air for forever. But there's laws that went into place after the Second World War during Nuremberg that basically reflect a little bit of higher consciousness that if your government is exterminating people or committing crimes against humanity, then you are responsible for interrupting that if you know about that. So that, I would say, is a pretty firm spiritual law, but that it also has been codified and signed and ratified by the United States in Nuremberg. And we know that laws are chosen, picked and choose from which ones that are going to be upheld. And but we like to think that we are standing on firm footing, one, to call a halt to this, our government's war crime, and to actually do that disarming ourselves as a matter of responsibility, so that this is actually upholding the law, and that's why we call it civil resistance.
So you just talked about international law and national law that would make these weapons illegal, and yet at the same time, obviously, we operate in a world and in a country that is highly armed. How do you hope that your actions can affect that?
Yeah, so I think we're getting right to the heart of things, Sasha. A nonviolent symbolic disarmament action. When I first heard about the Plowshares 8 action back in the early 80s, I was living in New York City. I'd been doing community organizing with the United Farm Workers, and I heard about this hammering of a nose cone in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, the Mark 12A. And I thought, well, for one thing, that's dangerous. But apparently it was just the nose cone, the metal part. And the second thought I had was, oh my God, that's ridiculous. If they're thinking they're going to have this government disarm itself, that's like asking the government, U.S. government, to decapitate itself. It's just not going to happen. And after I identified that sequence for myself, I realized, oh, they're not asking anyone to do anything. They're doing it themselves. So that's kind of like a different orientation that says, well, especially with these laws that are unenforceable, really, you know, like who's gonna force the biggest bully to do anything, like without, I mean, using weapons, right? Or it's like it either has to happen manifested by the grassroots, or and I trust, Sasha, that there, in my 60 years, that there is always movement when anyone takes one part of this ball of wax and acts truthfully, acts justly, takes down the veil of falsehoods, that it makes space for all of us, space and energy for all of us to know a little bit more about the truth, to know a little bit more about human possibilities and sort of universal assistance. There's like a, I would say, divine sort of arc of the universe is how I see it, at least. So it opens up possibilities. With other nonviolent symbolic actions that I consider to be civil resistance, upholding the supreme laws of our land, when they resonate as true with people, who some are community organizers, like with the St. Patrick's 4 action here in Ithaca in 2003, when we poured a small amount of our blood in the entranceway of the Marine Recruiting Center. Eventually, when we had our second trial, we went through two trials, and the second one was a federal trial and was held in Binghamton. And there's an incredible community organizer there, Tarek Abdulazim, who recently ran for mayor. But he heard about our case, interviewed us, and then he made it like he tagged on and did his own thing. Like he organized a citizens' tribunal and had all these people sort of testify to what was being kept out in the courtroom. So all that is, I imagine, to be on a continuum of more truth, more critical analysis, more sense of people's power. And I can only trust that will move us forward, those things.
And we'll talk more as we go on about the relationship between these actions and wider movements opposing nuclear weapons. But I wanted to ask you, Martha, about the situation that you are in right now in terms of the case that seven of you broke into the Kings Bay Trident submarine base last April. And four of you, I understand, are out on bail, living with GPS ankle monitors and under curfew. And three are still in jail. Tell us about their situation and your situation.
Yes, the three who remain in jail are Elizabeth McAllister, Stephen Kelly, Jesuit priest, and Mark Koval. Mark was out briefly for cancer treatment, but is now back in. And the four of us, Patrick O'Neill, Carmen Trotta, Claire, and myself, chose to take the $5,000 bail and the $50,000 bond and the ankle monitors so that we could come out and start to speak about the situation with our nuclear arsenal and to try and do more public education. And so our lives are quite restricted. I think that the ankle monitors do function as a gag order rather effectively. We're not allowed to travel without permission from the court. I myself spend time between my home in Vermont and doing volunteer work at the Catholic Worker in New York City. But we are working very hard to get the story out about this action and the concerns we have about our current nuclear threat.
So what is your legal status at this point? Obviously, you're under these restrictions, but what is the status of your cases? What kind of charges are you facing?
We face charges of conspiracy, depredation of naval property, destruction of government property, and trespass. And we are using the Religious Freedom Restoration Act as part of our defense. And we are still waiting from the courts to make a decision about whether to accept our motion to dismiss based on religious freedom. And that has been going on to 12 weeks now. January 16th was the last activity that we had in court where supplemental briefs were submitted. And so we suspect that the courts are working very, very hard to try and address this particular and unique approach that we're using for our case on nuclear disarmament.
So is it fair to say then this religious freedom defense is something that has not been historically used in the past? I mean, as we will discuss, there have been more than 100 plowshares actions. What is the legal basis of this one contrasted against some of those?
Yes, I think that Liz McAllister and her husband, Phil Berrigan, did try to use this defense and did raise it in the 1980s. And I don't know the details about why the court refused to accept it, but we now have the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which came into play as of 1993. And as far as the legal basis for trying this particular approach, one of our attorneys just came up with the idea, and it was very much, he said, your case has been hijacked by the Holy Spirit. And as far as the legal arrangements go, of course, it's not good law. It has now been used to discriminate against employees regarding birth control and health insurance coverage. But we are hoping to use it in a manner that shows that our faith compels us to take the action that we took and to be held under this sort of Damocles of the nuclear holocaust that we're so capable of producing. We are saying this goes against our faith, and we just have no idea what the outcome is going to be, obviously.
And you're facing up to 25 years in federal prison each, is that correct?
Yes, I think each of the counts, trespass is 6 months, it's a misdemeanor, but the three felonies, I think they're threatening 5 to 10 years each.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm talking with Martha Hennessy, whose voice you just heard. She is one of the seven defendants in the action against nuclear weapons at the Kings Bay Trident submarine base in Georgia last April. She is joined by Claire Grady, another of the seven who face serious charges in federal prison for their actions. My name is Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So this was the 101st Plowshares action taken since 1980, and Claire, you mentioned your awareness of the first. I wanted to ask you about the history of those actions, starting with the first, which the radical priests and brothers Daniel and Philip Berrigan took part in and ultimately was depicted in the film In the King of Prussia. What was that first action?
So the first action was the Plowshares 8, it was called. And it was in King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, at General Electric, where they make the nose cones for the Mark 12A warhead. And there were eight people. It was September 1980. It was eight people that went in. There were several priests. So anyway, that was the first Plowshares action. And I think that it's fair to say that action have stood in the tradition of nonviolent symbolic action from the decades before, during the Vietnam War, with Catonsville being probably one of the more outstanding or historically noted cases where they burned draft files in a garbage can and went to trial saying it's better to burn paper than lies. And so anyway, this was the first of quite a few actions. Several a year took place in the following years after that first action. And my sister Ellen and my brother John took part in the Plowshares number 4, also disarming part of the Trident submarine. This was an Electric Boat in Groton, Connecticut, where they're being made, where, by the way, 12 more are commissioned. That's quite a lot of trillions of dollars. To be made at that same shipyard in Groton, Connecticut, in the near future. But anyway, that action, the Plowshares number 4, I think was the fourth Plowshares action, and it was in 1982. And then I actually went to their trial and realized how I felt moved with a sense of obligation and sense of inspiration to actually do something, because I was given so much knowledge, not only about the weapons themselves, but about U.S. courts and how they were upholding these omnicidal illegal weapons, protecting them, and they were silencing the people. And it seemed like a really good thing to take part in that movement to push back that kind of silencing and to act truthfully and justly with this kind of disarming process. I think what's really important for me to say, Sasha, is that when I did that action back in the 80s, it was 1983, the doomsday clock was 3 minutes to midnight, and I was in my mid-20s, and I really felt the sense of urgency that if these weapons are launched, we will see omnicide. And now, when I took this action in 2018, my sense has grown to see that these weapons are deadly even if we don't launch them, that they are used every day in the way a cocked gun is used. And even if you don't pull the trigger and launch that bullet, that gun is being used if you're holding it to someone's head. So that's actually an image that Daniel Ellsberg offers, and I totally have felt that way for many years now, in recent years, seeing that this weapon is like the biggest bully stick on the planet, and that there's everything that its power and threat, even though it's really used as a threat, has everything to do with the entire chain of violence state-sponsored violence down to the police gun on the street. And there was a speaker, someone at Cornell, a few months before we took the action. I was grateful to hear this fellow speak about nuclear weapons and international relationships. And he described how South Africa, for the time that they had nuclear weapons, they increased their military aid to the neighboring efforts of putting down liberation struggles in the neighboring countries in South Africa. And their military presence just increased like four or fivefold once they possessed nuclear weapons. Like, there is a relationship. I mean, it's just kind of like an old-fashioned bully mentality when you have the biggest weapons. So that was in my mind this time. And also, really notably, the mining of uranium, the refining, the testing, and the dumping of radioactive material all happens on indigenous land. And that happens on a regular basis. And that's a cost that is mostly invisibilized, but we'd like to bring that out, to make that visible and to lift up the voices and the work of the indigenous organizers down in the Southwest. There's a nuclear issues study group, and Leona Morgan is one of the main organizers, or one of the many. And here in New York, in Seneca territory, in Western New York, is the organizing by Agnes Williams and Maria Mabee, because we have a nuclear dump site there that has contaminated the Cattaraugus Creek, and that's on Native land. So that's the second thing. And then the third thing is just the cost of these weapons is nothing less than a theft from all the good things that we need as human beings and community. We're basically being robbed. 50 cents of every dollar goes to the military. So
indeed,
for those reasons, that's an additional reasons that were compelling for me to disarm this weapon, which I believe is the linchpin for all these systems that enforce white supremacy and global capitalism.
And yet, in thinking about the first Plowshares action in 1980, during the Cold War era, and a sense of urgency that activists had about nuclear weapons, obviously in many ways culminating, in terms of numbers anyway, in 1982, when 1 million people protested in Central Park against nuclear weapons. So there was a sense of urgency, of threat, that saw itself manifested in all sorts of activism throughout the 1970s into the 1980s. But in contrast, we have now, although these Plowshares actions have taken place pretty consistently from that period up till now, you don't have equivalent movements today of the kind in the 70s and 80s against nuclear weapons. And I wanted to ask you why you think there is that sense that nuclear weapons are no longer a threat, or such a threat that we need to mobilize around it.
Yeah, that's such it's an obvious observation that many of us have watched. And I remember being there at that time of 1 million people in Central Park, and thousands of us risked arrest the next day. The way I want to see that, Sasha, in a positive way is, I mean, I guess there's several ways like I see it. And one of them might be in a little negative way, that people just lost, stopped connecting the dots, or a sense of urgency on that one. But I like to think that people were attending to things that were left out before that. And so, for instance, racial justice work was really not in focus as much in the 80s, perhaps with some people and in some parts. But I'm so grateful for that, the emergence of that movement, and climate justice. And I mean, all these things are connected. And as far as kind of moving past that, I don't feel everyone has to do everything But I like at least when our analysis connects the dots and sees where we're giving away our power and where we have choices in reclaiming our power and creating a new society in the shell of the old, or wherever we are. And so I have this little corollary that's come up for me. It kind of comes up with your question. I believe that when people of privilege, so myself, a white woman of privilege in this United States, take responsibility for the big crimes of killing millions and stealing trillions, and that's done certainly with nuclear weapons, but in many ways that is done. When we take responsibility for those crimes in all the different ways that we can, we will stop scapegoating the people on the receiving end of those crimes. So I had that huge insight when I was in a prison cell one time waiting to go see a judge. And I realized, you know, whenever I'm in prison or jail, I don't call that crime that people are in there because they are living the legacy of big crimes. And they are certainly experiencing addiction and violence and brokenness. And all of that needs healing. But I just don't practice using the word crime unless it's for these big systemic institutionalized crime. But anyway, there's this corollary for me. And I'm hoping that we see the connections enough to, withdraw our consent and stop fueling the money and stop fueling our blessing and our taxes and our everything to this machine, which is one of the biggest contributors to climate change, absolutely puts people of color on the first line of deadly force, and drives global capitalism with a vengeance. It's just a small effort, but sometimes little things make space for bigger things, and I hope it's a complementary effort to all the good organizing going on.
That's the voice of Kings Bay Plowshare 7 member Claire Grady. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm joined by two of the seven defendants in the Kings Bay Plowshares case. They took an act of civil resistance at the submarine base in Georgia last April on the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination against nuclear weapons. They each face up to 25 years in federal prison. And we are talking today about the threat of nuclear weapons and activism against nuclear weapons. And I wanted to ask you, Martha, about the situation, the change situation over the period that these plowshares actions have taken place from 1980 to the present. While there is a sense within the public more broadly that the threat of nuclear weapons went down after the Cold War, there are things that have happened recently that have made the threats that never went away even more dire. And one of those is the decision by Trump to withdraw from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. And of course, all of the saber rattling around Iran. And I wanted to know from you, Martha, how you see the situation now. Some of these developments, of course, having taken place even since you all took action in April of 2018.
Thank you, Sasha. You know, I think the breakup of the USSR was a golden opportunity, and the United States just immediately abused that opportunity to become the sole superpower. And, you know, my children were born in the late 70s and early 80s, and the nuclear threat is far from their minds. And I think that the longer we practice war, the more we perfect it. And so our lessons learned from the Vietnam War and our lessons learned from the end of the Cold War only were used to further our agenda of, you know, white supremacy, hegemony, and exploitation of the global resources. And as far as what Trump has recently done, this withdrawal from the INF treaty with, you know, threats to the New START treaties upcoming in 2021, and the ending of the Iran nuclear deal, all are clear indications to me what the intent is of the U.S. in terms of its willingness to dominate the globe. I have had trips to Russia. I have had trips to Iran and several other countries in the Middle East, and it's very clear to me what the intentions are. You know, I have great hope. I have great hope that the citizens will demand the reforms that are needed and that we do take advantage of our democratic system that we do have in place. I will never forget sitting in the apartment in Cairo with an Egyptian activist, and he just simply looked at me and said, "You have the means, you have the democratic means of protesting what was going on, and you need to utilize that." You know, Egypt is a completely suppressed police state, you know, given the financial aid from the United States to maintain that regime. And this is what we're faced with, a multiple pronged approach to oppressing our poor people here at home as the counterpart to the war-making that we commit abroad. And there also is the problem of our media. I mean, one of the most important aspects of a democracy is a free press. And under the current circumstances with the current administration, we are in deep, deep trouble. And this has been in the making for at least 40 years, from what I can recall. I have been aware of social justice and war-making my entire life. I was made aware of it by my mother and grandmother, even as a young child. And what we're seeing now is an obvious conclusion to what we have been practicing since dropping the bomb on Japan.
Well, Martha Hennessy, what about the issue of near accidents? Clearly, when they happen, we don't hear about them. Often we don't find out about them for years or decades after the fact. But when many people have a sense that after the Cold War, they don't have to think about nuclear weapons anymore, what do we know about the threat of near accidents?
What's called the Nuclear Posture Review that came out in February of 2018, and every new incoming administration is obligated to review this. And the current administration has made some changes about computerizing more aspects of the nuclear program. And of course, we have had many near misses throughout the history of our nuclear age. They're called broken arrow incidences, and we don't have a lot of information about what has happened. And this is where my faith comes in. I mean, we have not yet blown ourselves up, and it's a complete miracle. We have the capacity to make these mistakes, and we are coming closer and closer to making even greater mistakes. But more than that, Donald Trump wants to use the nuclear arsenal. He wants to make these weapons usable as part of his strategy of domination. And so we drift closer and closer to the dangers that Nuclear Posture Review talks about, a nuclear response to a non-nuclear threat. Now, this is crossing a very different threshold. This is not maintaining the status quo with this document of our nuclear strategy. This is opening the door for much greater danger. And we also have the information about the B-6112 missiles that are used for dial-up, the dial-down kilotons. They can control the size of the explosive, which they're talking about putting on these nuclear subs. And the subs are stealth machines. You don't know where they are in the oceans on the globe. And this kind of so-called upgrade is increasing the dangers exponentially.
Martha, are you concerned about Trump's withdrawal from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty and other such actions as spurring a renewed arms race, in that if the U.S. is pulling out of these things, why should any other country control its nuclear proliferation?
Yes, pulling out of the INF treaty is clearly leading to a new nuclear arms race. And we are going in the opposite direction. The non-proliferation treaty is something that has been in place since the 1970s, I believe. And we are moving no closer to preventing the proliferation. In fact, we're going in the opposite direction. And once again, the hand of capitalism is playing a part in this. The nuclear arms race and just the conventional arms race is probably the largest profiteering operation that we have at this time. And, you know, Mr. Trump is a businessman, and his job is to free things up for the capitalists and the businessmen to make their profits with no regard to where it's leading us and what the consequences are. And we also have the New START Treaty to consider, and I believe that John Bolton has the plan of just very methodically withdrawing from any of these restraints that we have on nuclear proliferation. And I don't believe that they have the capacity to understand the insanity of what it is that they're doing.
Martha Hennessy is my guest. She is one of the Kings Bay Plowshare 7 activists who are facing serious jail time in federal prison, decades, in fact, for the action they took of civil resistance against nuclear weapons last April. What companies are key to the nuclear industry? Because, Martha, you were just talking about the dimension of profit in all of this. What companies are involved, and what are the efforts to target those companies?
Very good question. I know Lockheed Martin is very much on the top of the list. Northrop Grumman, Raytheon. I don't understand, you know, why we're not looking more closely at the economics of this, because, you know, these very few corporations are netting billions of dollars of taxpayers' money and resources of the country. You know, it's public dollars going into private pockets. And I think that once you practice this mode and you gain a certain level of controls, it's very hard to counter. And you have a combination of the people being kept in willful ignorance, and you have the corporations making the decisions, and you have the government. I mean, the definition of fascism is when corporate is running government. And I believe that we are in the advanced stages of that, where it's the capitalists who are making the decisions. I mean, we have neglected our democracy. And as far as changing that, Phil Berrigan and Martin Luther King Jr. both called for general economic strikes. And I do believe the people have the power to shut down the economy, to refuse to work and to shop, and to have a list of changes that must be made. And that seems to be the only way that we can bring this into check. And again, personal sacrifice will be part of this picture. We can call for a general strike, but then we have to face the consequences of the suffering that will come from that.
Well, this undoubtedly is a more moderate type of effort, but tell us about the campaign for divestment from nuclear weapons.
Yeah, so I think it's Cold Pink that's been that took that initiative, divest from war, and they have tons of resources. If you look on their website, of what those weapons makers are, and they sort of have a template of how to go about that organizing, and they have organizers that will help you in whatever area you live in. So here in Ithaca, we have some organizing going on around that. We also have the ICANN grassroots effort that asks city councils to call for a nuclear-free zone and do that connecting of dots verbally.
And then in terms of the struggle against the existence of nuclear weapons, what kind of actions, Martha Hennessy, would you like to see people take, or would you encourage people to take?
I think that citizens of the United States should really put pressure, you know, on their representatives and congresspersons to support the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons that was developed by ICANN and the United Nations back in July of 2017 to get that treaty ratified. And of course, the 9 nuclear states are refusing to support it whatsoever, but I think citizens' demands for support of that treaty would be very helpful.
The ICANN, the movement for the prohibition, I think, was initiated by Costa Rica, and there's, I forget the woman's name, but she's a Costa Rican woman who, it's just really striking how grassroots this is. And
yes,
of course, Japanese people are leading the way with that. And just that, you know, it's like people of color in a grassroots way are running with this ball. And it's a beautiful opportunity. If James Baldwin were here, he might jump in and put his name on it again. But it's one of those quiet grasshoppers, maybe. And because it doesn't have teeth, it may seem ineffectual, but I can't emphasize enough the value of this kind of grassroots thing, and they are making a lot of connections. They are connecting dots with their efforts.
Martha Hennessy, we've been talking about the anti-nuclear movement through Plowshares actions, both this recent action that took place last year, but going back really to 1980, and as Claire said, that movement to take nonviolent civil resistance, actions of nonviolent civil resistance against nuclear weapons, against the military over almost 39 years now, with, you know, serious consequences for those involved. And remarkably, a lot of people who have been involved in those actions and went to jail for it then have been involved in other actions. So it's a movement that has sustained itself over decades when there has not been a larger mass movement during all of that time focusing on nuclear weapons. And so something like that, an effort like that, doesn't just come out of nowhere. It's sustained by a community and by a philosophy or faith. And I wanted to ask you about the longer roots of the sort of communities that the Plowshares actions have come out of. And I wanted to particularly ask you about your grandmother, Dorothy Day, who was the co-founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. Who was Dorothy Day? What was the Catholic Worker Movement?
Dorothy Day was born in 1897. She died in 1980 when I was 25. And she was a Catholic convert. And she met Peter Maurin, the other co-founder of the movement. And the movement was born in 1933 in the depths of the Great Depression and, you know, significant mass unemployment and mass displacement internally in the country. You know, the failures of capitalism became very, very apparent. And for Dorothy and Peter, it was a question of following Catholic social teaching and ministering to the needs that are immediately in front of you. And she was in New York City, the empire city of the empire state of the U.S. empire, and her response was to follow in the tradition of Matthew 25, of feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, visiting the imprisoned. And the movement continues today. It's 85 years old. There are over 200 houses of hospitality, you know, around the country and around the world, trying to minister to the desperate needs of the homeless and picking up the pieces of the human wreckage of our capitalist system. And Dorothy clearly understood what was brewing in Europe with Hitler and World War II. And she witnessed many wars in her lifetime. And in September of 1945, she wrote a scathing piece regarding the dropping of the bomb on our Japanese brothers and sisters and breathing in the dust of those we have incinerated. And her understanding of the mystical body of Christ, being that we are all one of another, and what damage we do to one people, it's going to damage all of us. And she had a very clear understanding of that. She also began the protest, the non-consent with the nuclear air raid drills. They were arrested consistently from 1955 to 1961, sitting out on the park benches, refusing to take so-called shelter in the event of a nuclear attack on Manhattan. She understood that to be a psychological war, and that people would be going to their graves to go down into the subway system for any kind of protection. And so for myself, having grown up in that milieu of knowing that war-making is always targeting the most vulnerable, the poor, women, children, and Dorothy and Peter had a vision of, you know, creating a better world in which it's easier to be good. And so these roots are rather deep. And Peter Maurin himself goes back centuries in terms of his family's commitment to the land and to agriculture. I think that there are so many moving parts of the dilemma that we have today of climate disruption and nuclear holocaust. But I, for Peter Maurin, the way that we produce our food is actually quite critical in the whole system. And the capitalist system has certainly exploited that approach in terms of gaining control of the food supply. And we also have the Atlantic Life community that Phil Berrigan began years ago. And this work cannot be done outside of community, as far as I'm concerned. I could not participate in what I have been participating in if not for all of that upbringing and training and understanding what is going on in the world and how we address poverty, war, and oppression. And we rely on the beloved community to be able to continue with these kinds of actions.
Well, let me end by asking you about the kind of support that, if people are listening to this program and they would like to support the Kings Bay Plowshare 7, what kind of support would you all find most useful at this point, starting with you, Martha?
I think the more we can educate ourselves, we have a website, kingsbayplowshare7.org. You can go there for further information. But I think educating ourselves on the nuclear arsenal, on the foreign policy as we have implemented it in all of these decades of war making, and also looking at how we have not held the Bush administration accountable for the war crimes. I mean, this is not something that happens overnight, and it's very important for us to study our own history and to study it, you know, with a frankness about why we have come to the place that we're at now with our democracy slipping from our hands.
And Claire, what kind of support would you like to see or inspired action from the action that you and six others took last April at the Kings Bay Trident submarine base?
Yes, keep doing whatever you're doing. If you're doing good work and organizing and teaching, and keep doing that. But if you're at all interested, coming to the trial is one way to support us. But also to keep the movement growing. And I know when I was younger and our parents were doing draft board actions, that there were hundreds of those draft board actions. And being at trials was one of the places, or sort of like a seminary or whatever, or people, because it happens, as Martha stated, in community. And that's where community is cultivated. And the courtroom, I understand it to be a place where it's the war, where the war of the myths goes on. A lot of unmasking that happens during trials. And that's energizing. And, you know, when Martha said study and so on, that's a classroom right there. And it's community building. And there's opportunities for more actions, sort of an integrated experience. So if you're drawn to that, coming to Brunswick, Georgia, whenever we do have trial, is one way to support.
And will there be information on the Kings Bay Plowshares website about the details of the trial as it becomes known? Do you have any sense of when that will be, when the trial will be, or is that just not clear at this point?
It seems as though the courts are working very hard to figure out how to get to the a conclusion that they need, you know, to silence our voices. And we're not sure how long this, I mean, it looks like non-cooperation on the part of the courts, but I think that they have the right to not make a decision for some time to come, but we are hoping that some movement will come in the next month or two.
Martha Hennessy, Claire Grady, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Sasha.
I've been speaking with two of the seven defendants in the Kings Bay Plowshares action that took place at the Kings Bay Trident Submarine Base in Georgia last April on the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination. They face up to 25 years in federal prison. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.